comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! It's Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, comic book fans of all ages. This is part two of Nerds United, episode 15, continuing the coverage and the conversation from the 2014 Cape Con, the Cape Girardeau Comic Con, which took place again the 21st, 22nd, 23rd of March, just a couple weeks ago. Yesterday, you caught the show. If you listened to it already, if not, it's still there. JitteryMonkey.com/NerdsUnited. Anyway, yesterday we talked with a lot of the vendors. We talked with some of the cosplayers. And we talked with the event organizer, coordinator. And that was Mr. Ken Murphy. Today we're visiting with not one, not two, not three, not four, but all five. That's right, all five of the featured guests. And so we're going to be talking with Brian Koshak and Douglas Peskevich, also Michelle Dalecki, Shane Davis, and the featured of all featured, Mr. Jim Cornette, pro wrestling legend Jim Cornette. I'm excited to bring this one to you. Hey, I got to remind you again, tell your friends, share this. You retweeting this, you sharing this post from Facebook, if that's where you saw it, that gets the word out. That gets the views up. I don't care about the views. I care about the listens. Spread the word. Help me out. I've got big things in the works. I still have, I feel like I've got prizes and giveaways coming out my butt. We've got the they're not actually in my butt. Relax. I've got the Cape Con bundle giveaway that I'm not going to do till we get to 100 likes. And so if that means if it sits in my office at the house, so be it, because I'm not at the house. I'm in the Nerd Dome right now. So if it sits in my office until we get to 100 likes, I promise I'm going to give it all away. What do we've got? We've got some signed prints from Shane Davis. We have a custom card from Douglas Peskevich. We have a ton of stuff. I mean, a ton of stuff. Practically everything that's out there from Stash Publishing, we've got it. And we also have the signed, my signed placard, if you will, badge to get into the Jim Cornette experience that was held that Saturday night of the Cape Con at the Cup and Cork. Fantastic little place there in Old Cape, Old Town Cape. I highly recommend it. Great beer, the Big Bison Ale. Big fan of that stuff. I've got all that stuff. It's all in a bundle. It will sit in my office until we get to triple digits on likes. So I'm begging you. I'm begging you. Spread the word. Help me. I look at it like this. I was inspired to start this podcast from the likes of Kevin Smith, who said, you know what, folks, just go out there, get a microphone, get some of your friends, and just talk, share stories. I've had friends on here, but I've also had creators, and we're going to hear from four of them, five of them, if you include Mr. Jim Cornette here today. But it's great. I love podcasting. I don't have the star power. My name's not Kevin Smith, you know? I don't have the star power that, oh, just because I'm somebody, people are going to listen. They've got to come for the content. I'm trying to bring you some quality content. And tell your friends. The more listeners we get, and obviously getting on iTunes eventually will help that, because it'll streamline the process. But the more listeners we get, the better opportunity we have to get some bigger names on the show. I'm very pleased with the folks that I have on the show today. And a reminder, we get up to 100 likes on the Facebook page, facebook.com/NerdsUnitedShow. We are going to give away the Cape Con contest prize bundle giveaway, whatever you want to call it. So without any further ado, let us then go forth and get into talking about Arsenic Lullaby, an original creation. We're going to visit with the artist, the writer, Douglas Peskevich, as we roll on. Part 2, Nerds United, episode 15, from the Cape Comic-Con.
Set phasers to fun.
And this time around, we're joined by one of the featured guests at the 9th annual Cape Comic-Con, and that is Douglas Paskevich. And I got the nod of approval. I said it right. Douglas, your primary project, it seems, over the last few years has been Arsenic Lullaby.
Yeah, that's correct. That's my self-published work. So yeah, I've done freelance stuff for Mad and other companies, but I try to keep Arsenic Lullaby autonomous so that all the intellectual properties, I think, are the best I can keep, and all the stories that are too horrible for other people I can put in there. So it's a nice go-to project.
Let's start at the beginning, your secret origin, if you will. At what age did you kind of discover the medium of comic books?
At what age? Second grade, I think. I don't know, I got my tonsils out, and so my uncle dropped off a whole stack of comic books, and I read them.
You lose your tonsils, you get a popsicle, and a bunch of comic books.
Yes,
that's a pretty nice deal.
Yes, I lost my tonsils, but I gained a career. So,
before then, do you remember? I mean, at what point did you kind of want to pick up the pencil or the pen and get to that creative side?
Oh, that was probably just as soon as I could pick up a pencil or a pen. My aunt was very talented, and my grandpa was a draftsman, so there's always, you know, that was like the go-to thing is to grab some scrap paper and draw. So pretty early on. Yeah.
And when, I guess when, the next question, when did you kind of decide to turn it into a financial, I don't want to say, what is the word? I'm going to edit all of this out.
No, you can call it.
Oh, great. At what point did you decide to, let's go, turn it into a career?
Well, I haven't decided that yet. Every day I still tell myself, I'm going to go do something else. This sucks, I quit. I'm going to go be a plumber or whatever. But I had done stand-up comedy, and I knew I could write. I didn't have anything of a stage presence because I was basically too young to even drink. I had to be chaperoned into these seedy nightclubs and stuff. And something about just telling the joke once appealed to me. Yeah, tell it once, draw it, you're done.
Right.
You don't have to repeat it every single night until you're sick to death of it.
What now, aside from Arsenic Lullaby, I want to touch on that, but you have worked, you were drawn last night in the Round Robin, or I can't even remember what it's called, but you drew an alien, a Martian, from Mars Attacks, which was beautiful. And it was a nice contrast because I know Shane had drawn a Joker in the other corner, so kind of nice squaring off of Joker and the Martian. But what all have you know as far as more mainstream, you know, on Mars Attacks? What all have you worked on?
Oh, Mars Attacks and Mad Magazine are probably the two biggest things people know of. The Round Robin was basically, there was four different artists up there drawing great big sketches in front of a crowd, and the first one I did a boogeyman that I had done for Mad, and I saw the other guys did like Spider-Man and the Joker and whatnot, and I said, well, I got to come up with a crowd pleaser because nobody knows who the hell this guy is. So I did the Martian from Mars Attacks, and stuff like that, it's fun, you know, to do someone else's stuff, and it looks good on the resume, and, you know, if somebody doesn't know who you are, you can draw them a Martian, and they can get their head around that a little bit better than a zombie fetus.
Instant street cred.
Yeah, exactly.
Arsenic Lullaby. It's not a title I'm familiar with. Walk me through a little bit about what this story's about.
Well, it's just a collection of short stories. If you recall The Far Side, picture that, maybe more mixed with a horror movie, and a little bit longer. You know, some of the stories go 8, 9, 10 pages. But sort of that same vein of humor where it's very strange juxtapositions and weird things combined, and then sort of walk those concepts into their most absurd paths. There's a few characters that reoccur. There's Voodoo Joe is probably everyone's favorite. He's a witch doctor, and he got cursed, so he has to live in the suburbs and help people get revenge on each other. So he's got all these strange magical powers, and he's basically helping some guy get revenge because he blew the leaves into his yard and stuff like that. So really horrible things happen to people for very petty petty reasons.
What's next for you, sir?
Well, I've got another edition of Arsenic Lullaby coming out. It's funny when you ask somebody who's like in a creative industry what's next, they're thinking about what they're working on next and not what you're going to see next. The next thing.
No. I'm fine with what you're working on next.
That's what I'm working on next. What people will see next is there's a animated cartoon on Comedy Central coming out April 2nd, I believe it starts. And the people who did Robot Chicken did that. And they had me do one of the shorts in, I think, episode 7 or 8. So that's the next big thing that I've done that people will see.
Obviously there's a sizable difference, but from your point, what's the difference between writing for a book or I should say drawing for a book and drawing animation?
Well, drawing for there, the biggest difference is I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I write and draw, you know, I combine. Very rarely do people have me just write something. So I'm not really have any practical knowledge of a script. My scripts are a collection of notes with scribbles and words and arrows pointing what motion's going to go where and whatnot. So that was the biggest difference, is I had to just write the words clearly enough for them to know what the hell I was trying to tell them. And it's a 3-minute short, and your rule of thumb on a script is that should be about 3 pages, you know, a page a minute. What they got for me was 12 pages. I didn't want to leave anything to chance, but I let them know way ahead of time. You know, they knew what they were dealing with. I said, you know, this is kind of off. Yeah, I've got the ideas and I'm good at writing, but you're going to get it in a format that's probably not what you're used to. So.
Well, I appreciate everything. Website, you know, plug that, you know, people can go and look at your work and get a copy of Arsenic Lullaby.
That would be arsenic-lullabies.com. That's plural, IES. And if you go there, there's plenty to see and do and buy to spend your money on, so I can solidify that career decision you asked me about earlier.
Yeah, because he really doesn't want to be a plumber.
I'd rather not.
Yeah, but you spent a lot of time at this. You'd like to keep going.
Well, yeah, that's the only thing. I've spent 10 years developing these skills. There's nothing wrong with being a plumber, but, you know, I don't want to have to spend another 10 years snaking out drains until I'm a master of snaking out drains. You know, I've invested the time to be so good at this. It would take me until I'm 50 now to be as good a plumber as I am a comic book illustrator.
Sir, I appreciate your time. Wish you the best of luck in Arsenic Lullaby and all beyond.
Thank you.
You ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight?
Talking now with Brian Koshak, another of the featured guests here at the 2014 Cape Comic Con. Brian, first of all, thanks for taking a few minutes to visit with me.
No problem at all. I appreciate it.
Let's start at the beginning. I've been using the term secret origin quite a bit. When did you first discover comic books?
I was reading them for my childhood, but I didn't look at them as an art form or anything. And around 12, saw Todd McFarlane's Amazing Spider-Man, and that changed everything. I mean, I was aware of people that drew comics and the idea that, hey, people do this. I want to do that too. And just immediately from that time, just really tried to get as good as I could.
So would you say that McFarlane was kind of the first name that was really recognizable to you?
He was the first one that just totally blew me away. I guess John Romita Jr. would have been the first that I remember looking at an old Amazing Spider-Man. It's like, oh, wow, this looks kind of neat. Oh, who's, you know, look at the credits. Oh, a guy named John Romita Jr. drew this. So, you know, there were a couple guys, Mike Zeck, stuff like that I was just, huh, okay. Because they were better than everybody else. You had to take notice. But with McFarlane, that was the game changer of it.
So what was it about McFarlane's style that really spoke to you or caught your attention?
There was electricity shooting off those pages. Yeah, it was like, this guy is on a different level, and everything's just popping off the page, and you know, he had some videos that he was putting out, kind of how-to type things, and he was saying, never make anything boring. If you have a guy standing there pouring a cup of coffee, spider him out a little bit, you know, make him, you know, just make things have more energy, and just make it crackle a little bit more.
Is that kind of a lesson that you learned at an early age in your creative process, in your drawing?
Yeah, I was just wanting to be emulating him for probably 2 years. That was the goal, was just to try to be Todd McFarlane. And, I mean, that's a dumb thing to do, but I mean, I was a little kid, so, you know. But then at a certain point, you're like, you know, I got to be me, but I'm going to take that lesson and put it towards it.
Career day at school had to be very awkward for you. What do you want to be? I want to be Todd McFarlane.
Yeah, exactly. No, at that time, there was not the geek culture of now. I mean, I kept that stuff secret. I was doing this by myself.
Which brings up an interesting point. I've heard a lot of podcasters or you know, people in our that share our interest. That, you know, did you put the comics away for high school? Yeah, I did, because I wanted to have a date, you know, type of thing.
Yep.
You got to kind of make it your secret.
Exactly.
You know, you got to throw it, you know, into the closet, so to speak.
Exactly. And, you know, it'd be totally different now where, you know, the cosplayers and stuff coming by, you got high school girls dressing up and stuff. I mean, that was totally impossible back when, you know, in my time in the 80s and stuff, not early 90s in high school. Totally ridiculous. I had a really great Killing Joke t-shirt, and I was like, I'm wearing this thing today, and it's badass, and people were like teasing me and stuff, because, you know, oh, little kid superhero Joker. Now everybody has that shirt, you know.
It's become a global phenomenon, and I don't know if it's a more dominant presence at the box office or in Hollywood, but everybody knows it now, and you're almost, I mean, it's what I like about, you know, this geek culture, this community. Very uplifting, very positive, very reinforcing. You don't have to, you know, both like Superman, you know, or like comics. It could be, you know, Star Wars, which you've done art for. It could be there are so many. Doctor Who has gained an immense following the last few years. But everybody's out here because it's something they're passionate about. I don't know if you saw that clip on YouTube, Will Wheaton, his speech to his unborn child.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was at a panel discussion, and he said, everybody, you know, can like their own thing, and it's all acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. And that's great that's going on, because it was not fun to just literally have to be, your life's goals and everything are top secret. You know, but now, I mean, everybody's, you know, we're progressing with that. People can be themselves and enjoy that.
So let's talk about your art, your work. As we mentioned, you've done some Star Wars. Let's start there.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience. That I drew it for, off and on, there were a couple gaps in between, but pretty much for 2 years, 2 years straight, really. And it was kind of odd because I grew up with Star Wars, but not really into the expanded universe stuff at all. And the gig came, and it was great, and that first script came, and I realized what this was going to entail. And I think that's one thing that maybe some people don't really realize or really even think about, and that's good. You know, they're reading it, but they don't really realize that there's somebody drawing it or writing it. That stuff is really difficult to conceptualize, an alien planet and its architecture and the costuming and all that stuff, you know. That's so it really, and with a deadline too, so
yeah.
You know, pedal to the metal, 12-hour days, 7 days a week, you got to be on, and sometimes you just can't because, you know, you're not on that day or something, and you just got to move on. So it was a really interesting learning experience, and it made me draw things that I would never have drawn myself, pushed me to my limits, and it was a really, really fun, interesting experience.
You talk about, you know, alien worlds and structures and architecture, but at the same time, it is Star Wars, so it's established. I mean,
sometimes.
Now, does that make it easier if it's if you're working on a character that everybody's familiar with, or does it add a little bit more pressure because it's a character everybody's familiar with?
Pressure. Yeah, you have to be on model, especially with Star Wars stuff. I mean, they are watching that. And if you draw a ship kind of wonky, you're going to get called on it. And if you draw somebody and their face doesn't look just right, you're going to get called on it. And especially for me, it was maybe a little awkward because my style is a little more cartoony. A lot of fans do not like that with their Star Wars. But, yeah, what was the question again?
No, I think you hit it. I think you hit about, you know, the pressure, maybe the magnitude of taking on the,
yeah,
of taking
on model. But then, yeah, and then it was fun to have stuff that doesn't exist yet. And there's a part in one of the scripts where it was saying, in the basement of the Jedi Temple is a collection of all the alien plants and animals and wildlife and stuff, kind of like a sanctuary for all these endangered creatures and stuff. That never existed before. I got to draw like 3 pages that took place in this thing. I thought that was, I had fun with that, you know. So that was cool to not have a model that you have to stick with.
What, you know, aside from the Star Wars, what else have you done that people can go out and check out?
My first book, Narcoleptic Sunday, with Jeremy Hahn wrote it. 2007 Oni Press. I think you can go on their website and buy it. Kind of a crime noir thing, 200 pages. Sex and violence. And that was what was kind of fun, is, you know, doing independent, kind of more adult stuff, and have that lead to Star Wars. It was kind of a strange choice for Randy Stradley to give me a Star Wars job. You know, I was like, huh, okay, you saw something in this crime thing for that. But so that was pretty cool. And then I've done a couple self-published things. Battle of the Sea Titans. Did that with my kids and kind of did a little movie trailer of that. And a couple others, just personal things that are, you know, still kind of in production and in various stages of publication. So.
What's next for you then?
Reteaming with Jeremy Hahn again. He, you know, he's a successful artist doing Batwoman right now, but he has some really good writing ideas, and we're collaborating again on another kind of, well, it takes place in the early 70s adult film industry, and it's like a heist thing that goes on in that setting. So it's going to be getting back to the pre-Star Wars kind of crime, you know, more adult material. So that's exciting.
So many porn mustaches.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be a blast. I can't wait. It's going to be fun.
Brian Koscheck, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate your time. Best of luck to you in all your future endeavors.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
No one cared who I was till I put on the mask.
All right, we're here at the Cape Con 2014, the 9th annual. We're visiting with Brian Rhodes, and he has been to all of the Cape Cons, correct?
Well, I've been the last 5 years, so I haven't actually been to all of them, but once I started coming, I've come every year.
And your book, you are a creator, which I love talking with creators on Nerds United, and your book, you write it. You draw it, Mike and the Ninja. Tell us a little bit about where the idea came from, Mike and the Ninja.
Well, actually, I was in high school and I had a website, but the website sorely lacked content. So I did a little bit of research and I discovered webcomics. There were a couple, there weren't very many in those days. This was like 2000, so you had Penny Arcade and PvP and a couple of other ones, and that was pretty much it. But the idea struck me and I was like, oh, I need to put a comic on my website. And so the project kind of started as kind of just a smattering of different ideas. There wasn't really any, I didn't do any pre-planning. I didn't know what the plot was going to be. I didn't know what characters I was going to introduce or anything like that. So it pretty much just started with a guy named Mike who meets a ninja named Stu at the unemployment office, and they have adventures together. And it just grew from there, and I started doing some planning. I came up with an actual plot, and some themes that I kind of wanted to go with, and it developed into a full-fledged webcomic with its own website, and then I collected the first story into a bound volume in 2009 and sold that at my first appearance at Cape Comic Con, and from there I put another new book out every 2 years after that, so I have 3 volumes now. That the third volume actually concludes the series. I'm looking to move on to a new webcomic or another comic book series or some other creative project at this point. But it was really fulfilling. I think it grew a lot. My characters grew a lot. So the series really did end up accomplishing kind of what I wanted it to once I had an idea of what I wanted to do with it.
If somebody's, you know, interested, all right, Mike and Stu the Ninja, they meet in the unemployment line, they have adventures. So if just that little snippet of you know, information or backstory is of interest to listener, how can they go about obtaining if they're not here this weekend? Can they find it online?
Yes, they can. If you go to www.mikeandtheninja.com, all one word, all of it is available online. It's a free webcomic. You can read the whole story there. If you read it and you find yourself hooked and you want to get the printed volumes, they're available on Amazon. There are links on the website.
Do you have kind of something going on, maybe rattling around, an idea maybe in your mind that you're contemplating doing next?
Yes, I do. I have a couple. I have an idea for a webcomic that would be, it's going to be about dodgeball, because whenever I was my senior year of high school and into college, I was a big dodgeball player, actually, and so there are a lot of ideas churning there, and
I think I saw you on ESPN 8, the Ocho, actually.
That's right, yeah, I was on there for one or two tournaments, but... So I've always wanted to write something pertaining to my dodgeball experience. I toyed around with the idea of doing like a nonfiction kind of history of it for a while, but I've lost contact with a lot of former players, so I think it wouldn't be as in depth as I would want it to be. So I think I'm going to take a more creative route with it and just kind of, you know, use a lot of the people that I met and a lot of the experiences that I had and base a story on those. And then I have another project in mind that would be more of an actual printed comic book series, and it would mesh sci-fi, like sort of a space opera like Star Trek or Star Wars, with superheroes. And I really haven't developed it much further than that at this point, but I have some ideas kind of in the works there, so we'll see where that goes too.
If comics, have they always been, you know, kind of a big part of your life?
They have. My brother got me hooked when I was 5 or 6 years old. He had we shared a bedroom, and he had bagged and boarded comics just lining the walls. And once I got to a certain age, he said, "Okay, you're going to start reading comic books." And I said, "Okay, I can do that." So he gave me an issue of Uncanny X-Men, and that got me hooked. And I've been a comic lover ever since. I don't really... I don't buy every issue. I collect a lot of trades, you know, and I'm a big fan of 80s and 90s comics. I'm not big into the modern day stuff. I don't know. I have too many interests. I've been plagued by this my whole life. So, and it's always, you know, in another 5 years, I might be, you know, buying all the comics from the 2000s at that point. So, but yeah, comics have always been a part of my life.
And as far as the creative side of it, was it the website that needed content, or have you always kind of, you know, been a bit of a writer or a bit of an artist? You have your own obvious style. It's sharp edges, looks like, but you know, have you been drawing or writing, or at least been creating, you know, using this as an outlet for even longer before the Mike and the Ninja debuted on your website?
Yes, I started making comics when I was 9 years old, and at that point, they were all just ripoffs of other things that I liked, but it really got me started, put me in a good direction, and then whenever I got into high school, I started, you know, creating my own characters, and it went from there. So yeah, it started at the very young age of 9, and I always tell people that forever impacted or forever created my inability to compute fractions, and I still can't do fractions today, and it's all thanks to making comics.
You mentioned Uncanny X-Men. Did you have like a favorite character, you know, from your childhood? Maybe that's carried over, maybe subtly influenced a little bit of your work, or maybe just a personal favorite of yours that you can dissociate from the creative side.
Well, Wolverine was admittedly always my favorite character when I was a kid. I don't know if a lot of his traits have really bled over into any of my characters, but he's an intriguing fellow, and the X-Men have always kind of, they were always my comic book, and that's thanks to my brother too, because that's what he read, so that's why I ended up reading also. In my later years, I've come to appreciate, I really like Iron Man. I feel like a bandwagon jumper, because once the movies came out, I kind of, you know, I bought some old essential collections of Iron Man and really got into those. But yeah, it was all Wolverine and the X-Men primarily were the big influences when I was a kid. I was kind of didn't really necessarily base any of my characters on them, but that I aspired to be like the X-Men, except maybe not as angsty.
Well, I'll tell you this: you're less of a bandwagon jumper than me when it comes to Iron Man, because I just have the movies. I had never went back and bought any of the classic volumes. So you get points in that, more points than I do in the Iron Man realm. But Brian, I want to thank you very much for your time, sir, and for joining me on Nerds United, and wish you and all your future projects the best of luck.
Thank you for having me.
I'm a doctor, not an escalator.
All right, we're visiting now with a renowned painter whose work has been in museums and galleries internationally, Michel Dalecki. And we're discussing this weekend that we are cousins by ancestry, Mahochko, Slovakian, and Dalecki has a Polish descent. So, Michel, first of all, welcome to the Cape Comic Con.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is a great honor. Thank you.
You again, painting. Let's talk about how you got first interested in art.
Basically, I grew up with a paintbrush in my hand. My father was an artist. My brother's an artist. My grandmother's an artist. And now I married an artist. And I went to school to be an artist. So basically, it's just I've been in... introduced to it at a very young age, and I kind of kept up with it for many, many years. So that's how I started.
it's the family business, so to speak, right?
Yep, that's it.
Now, anybody who went to cape-con.com and when they were checking things out, making their decision to come down here this weekend, they saw your work, mostly females, definitely an expert on the female persuasion.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you you like it. Basically, I tend to stick to female forms because, for one, I'm a girl. So
it's true. It's true. She is a girl, female.
Yeah, basically, like I know the form pretty well, so I feel very comfortable because I kind of know more or less what I'm going to be painting. So. And also, mostly female form painting has been dominated by guys for so many years that, I figured, it's something different and, maybe I should put my take on it and see how it goes. Maybe I'll get some cool fans.
And people come up here to the con, to the show, they see your table, you start on the right with some paintings of, Marilyn Monroe, get into Audrey Hepburn, and then as we go to the left, we finally get to some comic book characters, some heroines, if you will, and also some of the bad girls of comic books. Do you look at a picture and just try to mimic it, or where do you draw your inspiration?
Well, basically, the first thing I do whenever I start doing a piece, first thing I have to do is concept it and think of what I'm going to do, and then how I'm going to execute it. So basically. The first step is come up with some really cool color comps, and then I would think of a really interesting pose and think about who I want to draw. And then after that, I just kind of let it flow through me. Like if I think Harley Quinn, right? I think diamonds, I think, cards, Joker. Then basically I think of what colors would look good with her and what kind of pose would complement that. And that's basically how I execute things,
As I'm looking and more at the celebrity, the real people, can you take a character or a person and kind of manipulate them into any pose that you want? I do see the Audrey Hepburn looks like it, not the biggest Hepburn, expert, but is that not one of those stills from Breakfast at Tiffany's or something like that?
It is, actually. It is. You're right on the dot.
Yes.
Right on the mark. But basically, my Starlet collection, it's basically a nod to the 50s. It's a nod to American class. Back when people had to have certain standards, you weren't allowed to basically bear it all as much as the girls do nowadays. Back then, these were the groundbreakers, the ground shakers, the women that were, you had like Marilyn Monroe, for example. She was considered quite risque back in the day. I guess she would be like the equivalent of, I don't even know how to, because you really can't compare them. They were so classy back in the day, and they had a beauty, and it was very natural. There wasn't really, they weren't plastic so to speak, as much as the girls are today. And I know I'm maybe talking trash, but I don't mean it. I mean, it's just a nod. It's a very great, it's me trying to honor them for being so beautiful and such a beautiful icon of American history.
Any, I know that this weekend you started working on a Wonder Woman, and that it's really, I was here on Saturday and saw just the very beginning penciling. Now we've added some color, obviously the raven colored hair. You've got some of the gold accents, some of the red. It's just another iconic character that you're putting your own style to.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I actually, I really like Wonder Woman. So this is a treat for me to work on it. And I figure, you know, if I somebody just popped a cork. But no, I was trying to just get some work done, and I'm probably going to start on that as my next print. So you get to see the beginning stages of how I do things with the penciling and then the coloring and so forth.
Michelle, where can you be found on the World Wide Web? Facebook, Twitter, website?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have a Tumblr page, mdartstudio.tumblr.com. And you can also look me up on Facebook. I'm approachable. I'll probably say hi if you say hi first. So, yeah, look me up.
And somebody wants to go to the Tumblr and you know, look at all of your pieces and buy a print, they can do that as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Usually the best place to reach me is Facebook, and I will write back. I write back to everyone. Even if I'm, like, totally swamped with work, I try to get back to everybody, so.
Michelle, thank you very much for your time and your art, and it's very well appreciated. It has a very nice place here at the Cape Con.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much for appreciating my work. I'm very happy that you like it. Thank you.
Holy hole in a donut!
Visiting now with Shane Davis, the artist. You've seen his work. I'm a fan of his work. Rage of the Red Lanterns, because, of course, I'm a Green Lantern nerd. Superman, Earth One. What all else have you done, Shane?
Most recently, I did a graphic novel with Max Brooks and Mark Waid called Shadow Walk. It's mainly about a military unit investigating an energy output source in Iraq. It actually turns out to be like hell on earth coming out of the ground. So if you like Red Lantern stuff, I did get to draw like a lot of crazy demons that I wouldn't be able to do with DC. But it's more like me drawing monster demon-based stuff, you know, which a lot of characters out of Red Lanterns were, you know, I created, so...
Let's go back to the beginning. In your panel, you said that you kind of started drawing around 13 or so, but I imagine that you probably found comics a little bit before that.
Yeah, well, actually, no, it was about the same time. I think some of the first stuff I was buying was, like, you know, Rob Liefeld's X-Force stuff and McFarlane's Spider-Man stuff and Eric Larson's Spider-Man stuff were my favorites. Mainly Eric Larson's Revenge of the Sinister Six story arc and McFarlane's Spider-Man was the big stuff that I was into as a kid. So,
are those characters that you've kind of continued to follow through your career, certainly into adulthood?
Yeah, Spider-Man, I've always, like, if there's a good Spider-Man arc in the works, I'm always, like, perks my ears up and, you know, I'll get into it. But I've never had an opportunity to really draw a Spider-Man outside some covers and at Marvel and stuff. It's kind of weird because, you know, there's always these dream projects you're like, oh, you know, I want to get in comics. And one day I want to do a Wolverine arc or X-Men arc or a Spider-Man arc. But, you know, you have like this bucket list of things you want to get your hands on. And you think, like, if I just draw some covers, that's enough. But nah, you actually want a nice Spider-Man project one day, or, you know, something you can always point back to and say, here's this book I did, you know. And, you know, I was big into Batman, and I did like a lot of cosmic stuff. So I did like some of the older Hal Jordan, but around Zero Hour, Parallax era, but before that, you know, type that Hal Jordan. And then, you know, I kind of perked up when I saw Rebirth, but I was working around DC around that time anyways. So, you know, it was kind of a kind of a Hal Jordan Green Lantern fan, but I think he, when I came into, he had the side, the gray sideburns, like, so I wasn't really, and I was there when Kyle Rayner came onto the scene, but I never liked Kyle like I did Hal, so, like, I never really, you know, I liked the idea of Green Lantern, but I was never a huge Kyle Rayner fan, so.
As you get to working on this, did you, you know, go to an art school, kind of self-taught, where, you know, very, very, very detailed, very, very good work, just how, I guess, how did it come about?
I was a Kubert student, but I already signed this one. Might want to get him a nicer one, though.
Okay.
I was a Kubert student, but I was, you know, self-taught to some extent, so it's kind of a mixed match of things with that. Like, you know, a little bit. I mean, it's hard not to be self-taught to some extent because no matter where you go to school at, you know, you're going to, you know, eventually have to come up with your own solutions to problems. But I, you know, at the same time, I do, like, you know, remember back to a lot of the, you know, fundamental stuff that you pick up, you know, from art school. So it's an interesting mix. I think everybody's art school experience is a little bit different. So, yeah.
You said in the panel about 13 or so is when you kind of started drawing in this medium, or at least developing that interest in drawing. Was there anything that do you, first of all, I guess, do you still have any of those early sketches? You know, that early work, is it kind of fun to go back and see some of that stuff?
My mom does, and no, it's never fun to go back and see that stuff. Actually, she hides it from me because she knows, like, I don't want to see it, or I might just rip it up. So, there was two things I was notorious for drawing when I was a kid, and that was Spawn and Nightcrawler. For some reason, those were the two characters I always would draw over and over again. But before I got into comics, you know, I was drawing, like, my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle figures, but I didn't know what I would ever do, like, drawing. But comics seemed like something I could do. I knew I couldn't be an animator and draw the same thing over and over again, so it's kind of a interesting thing with that. Like, I saw comics as something like, okay, I could see myself drawing a comic page or a comic drawing and going on to the next panel, and, you know, and it, you know, it's, you know, nice. And then that's when, because I was reading the Archie Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comics, which was a pretty good run, I thought. So
How did you get to where you are as far as who gave you that first big opportunity?
You know, I did some small pinups or some short stories and some image books getting into the industry. But I was doing, like, you know, some fill-in issues here and there, some one-shot issues at Marvel. And then DC, I got, like, pretty big gig with my first job, Mysteries in Space, and then it just kind of went from that into, you know, DC saying, well, we need you on something, you know, that sells better than Mysteries in Space, and they just kind of pushed me into, you know, some of the Superman, Batman titles, and, you know, Superman, and, you know, Green Lantern. But, you know, it's sad because I always wanted solid runs on some of those things, but, you know, they would kind of gear me towards just Earth One stuff, and, you know, that was it.
It's got to be a nice feeling, though, for them to say, we need to get you on something that sells a little better, rather than it's not selling so good, we're going to have to let you go.
Yeah. It was interesting. It was it was a compliment. It's just, you know, at the time I was kind of comfortable kind of just being kind of where I was under the radar, so then, like, when they put me on different books, like, you know, it felt like there was more pressure to outperform, what I was doing before on those books because they were bigger than my previous assignments. So, you know, that kind of takes hold, and, you know, then you end up, you know, putting in more time and extra effort, and, you know, then I started noticing, look back, I was starting to change the way I was feathering and rendering, and even today I kind of still model and render differently than I used to, like, and from something I just recently did, like, it's constantly not evolving, just kind of like, especially now that my wife has been inking me on a lot of stuff, I've been detailing a lot more, which probably is weird. Like, I don't know, I'm giving her more work than I would a normal inker, so, like, it's kind of weird, but maybe that's some aggression towards my wife, I don't know.
Looking back at some of the stuff that you read younger, or stuff, you know, from the past that you've gone and picked out, is there an artist or two or three or several that jump out at you that, like, you know, as inspiring, or as, you know, let's see if I can, you know, get to that level?
I look back at a lot of the McFarlane Spider-Man stuff and Eric Larson stuff, and I was kind of thinking, like, it was like a lot of books I was reading around that time too that don't hold up. I'm actually constantly surprised at how well their stuff, I mean, there is no book out there that says well designed and well detailed as the McFarlane Spider-Man stuff was in Torment, and there's nobody drawing like such detailed superheroes as Jim Lee's X-Men stuff. And I mean, I don't know if printing was different or computer coloring, but there was a craftsmanship in that stuff that today we don't actually do. And so, like, I've really been taking note of that and actually kind of feeling bad, because I'm like, maybe I should, why am I not? Forget why is nobody else, but why am I not doing what, you know, people were doing then in the 90s? And a lot of people talk about 90 comics as they were bad, but if you look at the 90s stuff that McFarlane was doing at Marvel, or Jim, or Larson, and it's like, those are actually really good superhero books that we don't really perform that way today. Like, and it kind of seems odd in a way. I mean, they still had solid layout skills, solid storytelling skills, but really good anatomy, and they were dynamic. I mean, not now, the stuff when it got over to Image, you know, that kind of morphed a little bit, but right before Image, I mean, we don't really do those books today, I don't feel. I mean, I think sometimes we come close, but, you know, I think a lot of our books also are trying to look too much like movies, you know, which kind of hold us back from doing creative layouts and different stuff. Like, I think, like, we'd be a little bit better off to think less about movies when we're making comics.
Let's talk about briefly Superman Earth One. Kind of sits out of the canon of the character. Is that beneficial to you? Does it make a difference to you as the artist? I imagine it makes things a little bit different for the writer.
What do you mean?
A little bit different for the writer? Just, you know, if it's something that's out of canon.
Oh, yeah, I got you. A little bit more liberating, I guess. You know, more things you can do with that. Not so bad, you know, a lot of stuff you can do with that, so when you don't have those restrictions on.
Is there one character, I mean, I know Spider-Man, you said, is kind of on the bucket list, is there maybe one or more that you just, you know, before your time in
I would always love to do like a Silver Surfer thing, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen. You know, that's one of those things I would always love to do.
All right, Shane, I want to thank you very much for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
2014 Cape Comic Con, and the featured guest is I'd say he's the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will.
That's already taken.
All right, if the voice hasn't given you away, the man, the myth, the legend,
Jim Cornette, pro wrestling legend and friend to furry woodland creatures.
It is an honor, sir, to be visiting with you here, even if it's just for a few moments on Nerds United. A lot of people know about your life in the business of professional wrestling, and I'm only going to ask just a couple of questions on that, but my focus, the podcast focus, is comics, and you have a vault, so let's start there. What age did the comics, the funny papers, catch your interest?
Actually, I was reading comic books when I was 4 or 5 years old, Casper the Friendly Ghost, Wendy the Good Witch, but then I was at my aunt's house in Covington, Kentucky, and I was bored and didn't have anything to do, and she said, "Well, Jimmy, Larry and Richard, my older cousins, have some funny books down in the basement." And I went down, and there was this huge box of comics, Marvel and DC comics, especially Marvel's from the 60s, and on the top was Avengers number 1, which I still have. There's about 200 comic books in that box, and my dad, I was 6 years old at the time, my dad insisted I pay for them. I couldn't just have them for free, so I paid my entire weekly allowance at the time in 1968 was... 67, I should say, was 50 cents. So I paid 50 cents for Journey into Mystery 83, Avengers number 1, and about 198 other classic Marvel and DC Silver Ages from the early 60s. That's what got me started.
And looking back now, I mean, you know, when you're that age, you might not know the value. You just, you know, think, I'm going to get a box of comic books and pay 50 cents. But turns out that was a nice investment.
Well, it was. And as a matter of fact, I still have all that stuff. And before it was over with, I started going to flea markets and yard sales and back issue magazine shops. And my barber shop when I was a kid had a take one and leave one policy. So I'd take Archie's and Harvey's, and I would get Tales of Suspense 58, a very fine copy that I got from the barber shop in trade for an Archie. And before it was over with, about 20 years ago, I started selling a few select books here and there. But before I had stopped collecting, I had every Marvel superhero title from 1962 to 1975, and I had an equivalent number of DCs, plus I had some 50 stuff, I had a few Golden Ages, I had a copy of World's Best Number 1 that I got for Christmas when I was 12 years old, but my favorite book, which of course I still have, My Amazing Fantasy 15, I got in 1973 from the original owner, paid $25 for it, which is the most money I ever paid for a comic book. And the World's Best Number 1 was $100 even back when I was, you know, a young kid, but that was a Christmas present, so I didn't pay for it, so I don't count that.
So, what? Going back to maybe your youth, did you have a favorite title, a favorite character that really stood out to you?
The Fantastic Four hit me first, and I loved The Thing, because not only was he a tragic and conflicted figure, but also I liked it's clobbering time. And of course, the Hulk, you know, I always liked the big brawly brawners. Maybe that's what, you know, predated me getting into wrestling, but I was a Spider-Man fan, and I liked the Avengers, because that way you got everybody all in one book, and Thor. Thor is a very maligned and misunderstood superhero, but I loved the hammer. Maybe I just like to break things. I don't know.
So, real quick, let's talk about what Marvel is doing now on the cinematic scale. Are you a big fan, then, of the movies that they've put out?
Yeah, for the most part, there's been a few here and there that, you know, and I didn't like the whole Ang Lee Hulk thing going on. You know, I'm glad they rebooted that. Yeah, exactly. But I think, truthfully, my favorite series is the Iron Man series, because I love Robert Downey Jr. And if I'd have known that he was going to nip up over his drug problems and come back to make these major motion pictures, I wouldn't have sold my very fine copy of Tales of Suspense 39 for only $2,000 14 years ago. I would have saved it, and now it'd be worth $10.
You kind of talked about perhaps the big hulking figures. There seems to be a connection. You certainly see it at shows like this between comic books and professional wrestling. It's something, you know, kind of like that superhero status that many of those big names attain.
Well, it's a great crossover, and also, you know, the comic book fans and fans of stuff like that, they like larger-than-life personalities. They like, you know, the action and adventure of the whole thing. But also, there's just a crossover, because collectors like to collect things. And I've got one of the world's largest wrestling memorabilia collections also. So I find that I've always been a hoarder, but I'm an OCD hoarder. Everything's organized. You know, I've got it in boxes. I've got it filed, bag, boarded, etc. But I still hoard things. And I've always collected stuff like that. So as the wrestling took over, I stopped collecting comic books. When I got to be 16, I started getting into wrestling and making money at it as a photographer and a ring announcer, and also I got a driver's license, and also girls came into play. So something had to go, but I kept all the comics, but then I branched out into wrestling, and I've done the same thing with that. I've got wrestling memorabilia back to the 30s.
Do you have a prized piece to your wrestling memorabilia collection?
Well, actually, in this part of the country, it'd probably mean more than most. I have a complete set of bound St. Louis programs from all the events that Sam Muchnick promoted in the Kiel and the Checker Dome, later the Arena, from 1945, his first event, until 1982, his retirement. And there was only three sets of these made in the world. They were all made for the owners of the St. Louis Wrestling Club, Sam Muchnick, Pat O'Connor, and Bob Geigel. And I was lucky enough to get Pat O'Connor's after he passed away. His widow, through a mutual friend, made arrangements. And that's my prized piece, because I took the first set. It's like about 13 volumes bound. And I took the first set and had all the great NWA champions, Harley Race, Jack Briscoe, Dorian Terry Funk, Ric Flair, Lou Thesz, Gene Kaniski, and the man himself, Sam Muchnick, autograph them. So it's one of a kind in the world. And if anything, tornado comes, you know, the big flood comes, I'm carrying that out first, then I'm going back for my wife.
I was going to say, you know, not worry so much about the wedding album, but
she's on her own. If it comes a choice of saving the St. Louis programs or getting her out, I'm afraid she's going to have to dive out the window.
You have been around professional wrestling for how many years?
Oh, my God. I started in 1976 as a photographer and then became a part-time ring announcer, started writing the programs, doing magazine articles, doing a lot of PR. I had pictures printed as far away as the Japanese pro wrestling magazines, because American pro wrestling was huge in Japan in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And then I started as a manager in 1982, and I completed 30 years on the road in 2012, and I decided that was enough of, you know, 150 nights a year in a hotel and always driving and always eating on the road. And I pretty much retired from wrestling, semi-retired. I won't say never, but I don't do much. And I do comic conventions in the spring and summer. I've written some books on classic wrestling. I'm doing a podcast. Just finished a tour of England where we did the one-man show that I'm going to be doing here tonight at the, what is it, the Cup and Saucer, the Cup and Cork, the Cork and Cleaver?
The Cup and Cork.
One of those things. We did those in London, Manchester, Birmingham, Cardiff, Wales, and Glasgow, Scotland. And I'm doing a lot of yard work. I'm enjoying my time. I haven't seen my yard in the last 10 years, so I'm getting out and doing that for exercise. So I stay busy.
I know the scope of professional wrestling has changed so much since you got into the business. What would you say has changed the most?
You know, there's been so many changes, and that's another reason why I've had enough of wrestling after 30 years, because it just seems like now that a lot of people come up to me at the conventions, want autographs, look at my books and everything. They say, we used to love wrestling, but we don't anymore because it's too soap opera, it's too much talk, not enough action, it's too contrived, it's too manipulated, choreographed, however they say it. And it boils down to, in the old days, back in my day, you know, the guys were out there to do what they wanted to do themselves. They weren't controlled. They weren't told what to say and what to do. And for the most part, and now it's very, you know, the television networks found out in the late 80s, early 90s, hey, we can make a lot of money in this business, but, you know, they have to get more involved in it. And what's the recipe for bad pro wrestling? Just add suits. So when that started happening, the fun and the passion, the emotion, the it's an American art form. But all that has been kind of wrung out of it by the tightly controlled, always doing something for ratings, you know, TV networks and the people involved. And it's just not as fun as it used to be. And I'm getting older. I don't fall down on purpose anymore. So I'll leave it to the young guys.
Now you mentioned before the suits, so to speak, were as involved. And what we're doing is we're outside in the sun. Here, yeah. I'm wearing the sunglasses.
Yeah,
I'll face the sun.
There we go. Starting to burn my corneas.
You mentioned, the suits getting in the way. It seems like in the old days, everything happened a little bit more natural, a bit more organic. Rivalries got to, there was time for storylines to develop. Now it's, you know, rush to the next pay-per-view next month.
Well, exactly. And also, to be honest, in those days, it was more about who's going to win, who's going to fight for the title. Right now, I'd like to say the most successful pro wrestling promotion in the world is the UFC, because MMA has really come on, and they're using all the tricks that wrestling used to do. The fights are real. I'm not trying to say that anything's manipulated or there's any funny business going on, but the way that they hype their fights and the way that they get their personalities over, and it's a clear-cut issue. We're fighting for a title or we're fighting for a contendership, and there's not so much extraneous soap opera, and the people get more action. They still get colorful, unique personalities, but they get more action. And I think that that's what I enjoyed about professional wrestling and what I enjoy now about the UFC. I'm a big fan.
You work WWE / WWF, TNA, ROH, in fact, was probably most recent that
yes,
you did?
Yes. You know, Ring of Honor, I love the talent roster there, and I love the young guys. They hit hard. It's athletic. It's treated seriously as a sport and a competitive environment. And, you know, the guys really, they excel. They love the spotlight, and they love to go out there and perform and show what kind of athletes they are. So I love that style of wrestling instead of the hoo-ha and the soap opera. But unfortunately, these days, our industry leader is the WWE, and they have more money than the federal government, so it's hard for people to take wrestling seriously anymore, not only because it's been parodied so long as kind of a shell of its former self, but also that if you don't have a multi-million dollar budget to put on the TV productions, the mainstream fan thinks of it as a kind of a second-rate product. And that's not the case, because the guys go out there and give their heart and soul and their passion. They risk their necks. There's more serious injuries now these days than ever before, because the guys are trying to top themselves. And I think it's a shame that some of the other promotions don't get the publicity and don't get the respect that the WWE gets from the mainstream fan, because they see the production values and the budget. And it's all about heart and passion.
I never got the opportunity, or I should say, I haven't had yet the opportunity to see ROH live, but I've seen some independent shows in Illinois, over, you know, in the Metro East area, where, you know, still wrestling, you know, going back to the St. Louis days. I mean, it seems to me, and I'm not knocking any of the guys who've made it, but, you know, when you're talking ROH guys, they're trying to make it. They're trying to get that big salary deal. So, not knocking the John Cena's or the, you know, any of those, that ilk, but it seems like the guys that are on the ROH, even if they're main eventing, they still feel like they're on the undercard, and they're trying a little harder.
Well, yeah, you know, when you're hungry, you try harder. When you're well-fed, sometimes you get complacent. So you constantly want a change in talent, and you want the young guys to be able to prosper. That's another thing that I take these modern wrestling promotions to task, is they always try to sign the stars instead of the next star. And I always wanted to find the next star. We trained John Cena in Louisville. He'd been in wrestling about less than a year. Came from California. We trained him in Ohio Valley Wrestling, along with Randy Orton, Batista, Brock Lesnar, that whole crop of superstars that that has been on top for the last generation. But I was always looking for the next star, not the current star, because that's the one you don't want. It's like the stock market. You don't want to buy high and sell low.
Right.
You want to buy low and sell high. And so I was always looking for the next star in my training and matchmaking career, and I had a pretty good track record with that.
In your years in the business, who was, and maybe, you know, this is an unfair question, maybe it's not a question you can answer, but did you have just the guy that you loved to watch work?
Oh, gosh, I've been a fan of so many guys for so many different reasons, because you can't just pick, you know, who's the best wrestler, because that's like who's the best artist or who's the best singer. It's all subjective. But I always enjoyed watching Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat. Always, in the 80s, they were the state of the art. They were the gold standard inside the ring. And I always enjoyed watching guys like the NWA champions that I mentioned that were big in St. Louis, and guys like Bruiser Brody, who was huge in St. Louis. You know, St. Louis, since we're so close here, was really one of the great cities in North America for professional wrestling from the World War II days all the way through the end of the 80s, along with Chicago, Toronto, and maybe one or two other places. St. Louis was a magic place, and whether the Kiel Auditorium or the old Checker Dome, later the Arena, they had a lot of great talent, a lot of great wrestlers come through there and drew huge crowds consistently over those decades. And so it was a place that every wrestler wanted to go, St. Louis. If you could main event St. Louis, you could main event anywhere.
I feel like I could spend another, I don't know how much time. I know you.
Well, both of us could, but my wife would divorce me and kick your ass.
I don't want either of those.
She's manning the booth at the Comic-Con while we're out in back talking wrestling.
In all fairness, though, you guys were following the Louisville-St. Louis University game.
Well, that's true, but I was standing over her shoulder, where at least I was there and accessible to her if she needed me. But yeah, go Cardinals, by the way. University of Louisville going all the way in the tournament this year. They better.
You were awful close. You could have said, when you said go Cardinals, St. Louis fans might have got excited a little bit there.
Well, I'm not talking about baseball, but as a matter of fact, we're in the process of kicking St. Louis's ass in basketball, and that's the. I don't mean to insult anybody, but if it comes to them or us, it doesn't look like they're going to make it.
You are very eager for the Louisville and Kentucky rematch. You're hoping that the chips fall into place.
Oh yeah, and all Kentucky has to do, all they have to do, is get past undefeated Wichita State. And yes, do we have it?
We have it.
The word has come in. Louisville has defeated St. Louis. We are going 66-51. We're going to the Sweet 16. Kentucky better too, and then we're going to kick their asses.
Final question, Jim, and then I you're a very busy man. I'm looking forward to your show tonight. So, technically, two questions. One, the Jim Cornette experience. Can you sum it up to maybe cut a promo for yourself for somebody maybe in a upcoming town?
Well, I do the podcast every week on MLW.com, and you can go to JimCornette.com. There's a podcast link along with all my columns and articles, a lot of pictures, great stuff to read, wonderful products to buy for the wrestling fan and the whole family. But the Jim Cornette experience is, we talk about wrestling, we talk about politics, we talk about pop culture, we talk about current television, we talk about anything that pisses me off, because it's a Jim Cornette experience, and I love to get pissed off about things and talk about them. So tonight, live, everybody gets a chance to ask a question. It's very interactive with the audience, and I always say I don't prepare anything, so if the show sucks, that means the audience was bad, they didn't ask the right questions.
Fair enough. Final question then. Craig, who you met earlier, he has a podcast on our network as well. It's a wrestling, it's called Beyond the Squared Circle. He mentioned to me, he didn't ask you, but he mentioned to me, what was with the tennis racket?
Well, you know, when I first started in wrestling, the tennis racket, publicly, the reason was that I wanted to show everyone that I was athletic, even though I wasn't wrestling, I was just managing. I'm an athlete, too. But actually, privately, the reason was that I needed some reach on the fans that wanted to punch me out. So the tennis racket gave me about a 2-foot reach. As they came toward me, I could bip them in the head and then be gone before the smoke cleared and they realized that they'd been had.
Jim Cornette, thank you very much for spending some time. I be it comics or wrestling, I'm very appreciative of the time you've given me and to the listeners of Nerds United.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me. I've enjoyed being had.
So there you have it, folks. That is the wrestling legend Jim Cornette, and that wraps up our time here for episode 15. We split it up, two-parter, because that's how much content we had, that's how much fun I had, and how great everybody was to talk to down at the Cape Comic-Con. I encourage you to go to cape-con.com and see what they have working in store. Also, like Cape Comic-Con on Facebook, and Ken's already in the works. Next year is their 10th year, and they are going to be shooting for the stars. That's what Casey Kasem always said, right? Keep your feet on the ground, keep reaching for the stars. He said it a lot different, you know, in the classic Casey Kasem voice. That's right. I can't do it now on the spot. I used to be able to, but I don't have it anymore. But Casey Kasem wants you to remind you to keep your feet on the ground. I don't. I want you to be swinging from Gotham. I want you to be swinging from New York City and bothering the hell out of J. Jonah Jameson. I want you flying over and into the Fortress of Solitude. I want you and your powering of willpower to fly through space to planet Oa. Take the oath with the rest of the Green Lantern Corps. Folks, I want this show to be a success. I think it will. I need your help. Help me spread the word. And we'll give away the Cape Con bundle. Don't forget, we still have an active contest. I'm just waiting on you. Come on. Don't you want this special edition? Walking Dead number one. The Wizard World St. Louis Comic Con exclusive edition, Walking Dead number one. You can get the details on facebook.com/nerdsunitedshow. Episode 15 was a two-parter, was a lot of fun, and I'm excited to say, I'm going to go ahead, not spoiler alert, but I'm going to go ahead and drop the bomb now. Next year, Cape Comic-Con, I will still not be there for Friday because I have a job, but Saturday, I will be there all day, as well as probably getting into Sunday as well, not with my handheld device. I will not, next year, this time, have my iPhone. Instead, I'm going to have a table. I'm going to have the setup, basically a mobile studio. I'm going to have a banner. You will see me at Cape Comic-Con next year. Nerds United will be there, and instead of me going from table to table, people, you yourself, if you're there, you can come to me and we'll sit down like proper you know, podcasters, if you will, and we'll do it right next year, the 10th annual Cape Comic-Con. I had a blast. I'm looking forward to year 10 and beyond. I think Nerds United and the Cape Comic-Con will have a very strong relationship for years to come. I'm certainly hopeful of that. I've got to give a big, big thank you to Brian and Tim and the gang at Twilight Comics. That's my home comic store. I love going over there. They're my people. They've got my pull list. They know what I like. They're always good to, and fun to talk to. Good to rib with. And they are we're in the works now. It just matter of finalizing paperwork. But they are essentially an official sponsor of the Nerds United podcast. So if you're in the St. Louis Metro East area and you're looking for some comics, they also have HeroClix, Magic the Gathering, and Tabletop Games. I encourage you to go to Twilight Comics. They are in the Greenmount Crossing Plaza, I guess. I don't. You'd see it. It's right off the interstate. If you see Target, Cracker Barrel, Walgreens, if you're in that area, you're in the right place. A couple stores down from the Big Michaels. It's a small shop, great, friendly folks. I highly encourage you to check out Twilight Comics in Shiloh, Illinois. You can also Google it for all of your driving direction needs. That is it for me, episode 15, Nerds United, on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. I'll catch you on down the road.
Hi, everybody. This is Jim Cornette, pro wrestling legend. Listen to Beyond the Squared Circle on JitteryMonkey.com. You've made the right choice.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to JitteryMonkey.com.